Chapter 17. Go West, Old Man. Phil was headed to his home in Flathead Lake, Montana, for some rest and relaxation, which he desperately needed. In his own, if more detached way, he cared about winning and hated to lose, as much as Doug Collins did, perhaps more, and that took quite a toll year after year. Even so, everyone knew he would be back coaching in the league before too long. The game was in his blood. It was only 52. Michael was headed to his second retirement. Who knew one day there would be a third? In the meantime, he would play more golf and film more commercials and be Michael Jordan, a full-time job in itself. Myself, where was I headed? Good question. Somewhere out west, in all likelihood, where I could look forward to a warmer climate. Any place was warmer than Chicago. I also preferred the more free-flowing and less physical brand of basketball they played in the Western Conference, especially as I approached my mid-30s and the bumps and bruises didn't heal as quickly. I'd had enough of being pushed around by the Oakleys and Mornings of the world. There had to be an easier way to make a living. The Lakers were my first choice. With Shaq, 26, and Kobe, only 20, they were the team of the future. Perhaps with me providing veteran leadership, the team of the present. None of the Lakers except for Robert Horry had earned a ring. Los Angeles seemed perfect for me. Phoenix was another possible destination. Except the Suns, while extremely talented, weren't on the verge of winning a championship. After the success I enjoyed in Chicago, even in the year without Michael, I couldn't imagine settling for anything less. In the end, I joined the Houston Rockets. They were on the verge, or so I assumed. I didn't come aboard until January of 1999. That's due to the NBA lockout that had threatened to cancel the whole season. Once the players and owners finally reached an agreement, it was decided each team would play just 50 games. That was fine with me. I'd had another operation on my back in July. It turned out that I had played the final three games against the Jazz with two bulging discs. The deal was for 5 years and $67 million. The payday I waited for my whole career had finally arrived. For that, I had someone I never expected to thank, Jerry Krause. By agreeing to a sign-and-trade with the Rockets, the Bulls made it possible under league rules for the deal to be worth at least $20 million more. Perhaps Jerry wasn't such a bad guy after all. I called him shortly after everything was finalized. The conversation went well. Despite everything, I never forgot the chance he took on me. What if I had been a bust? Who knows if the Bulls would have become the Bulls? If not for Jerry, I would probably have ended up with a franchise that was hoping to rebuild, that didn't have Michael Jordan. Maybe it would have worked out regardless, and I would still have been one of the greatest 50 players ever, as I was named by the league in 1996, prior to its 50th anniversary season. And maybe I would still have picked up my share of rings. Maybe not. I looked forward to working out with my new teammates in Houston, such as the future Hall of Famer Hakeem Olajuwon, who had just turned 36 years old. The Bulls never had a big man close to his caliber. So Hakeem was not the player he was in his prime. Neither was I. One guy, unfortunately, wasn't at practice. He was playing golf at the Bob Hope Tournament in Palm Springs, California, where the amateurs, including celebrities, compete with the pros from the PGA Tour. I'm referring to my teammate from the Olympics, Charles Barkley. I remembered reading some article where Michael said Charles wasn't dedicated enough to win a championship. I didn't agree. Charles worked as hard in practice as anyone else on the Dream Team, and in the games themselves, left everything on the floor. On the other hand, his decision to play golf, with Michael of all people, after the lockout ended, wasn't a good sign. We needed to be on the floor, all of us together, as soon as possible, to see how we meshed as a unit and what we needed to work on. The new condensed 1998-99 season would be here in no time, where every game would take on greater significance. He showed up eventually, and when he did, he was the same old Charles. At 35, Charles was still one of the best players in the league. Hakeem, Charles, me. A big three before big threes became the trend in the NBA. What could go wrong? Plenty. A month into the season, despite playing more than 40 minutes a game, with the Bulls I had never averaged more than 38.6, my scoring was way down. And there was a reason. Two reasons, to be precise. Charles and Hakeem. I kept feeding the ball to them in the low post. That was my whole job, which meant a lot of standing around and watching them play one-on-one. I was used to the triangle, to the ball moving from one player to the next on every possession until we found the best scoring opportunity. I felt as if I were back in the late 80s watching Michael throw up a million shots night after night. The game wasn't much fun anymore. I wondered, why did the Rockets want me in the first place? Anyone could throw the ball into the post. Just then, we started to win. A lot. 9 in a row over the final 2 weeks of March, 5 of them on the road. Gaining the number one seed in the ultra-competitive West was a real possibility. Unfortunately, we managed no better than about 500 ball down the stretch. Still, the team finished a more than respectable 31-19, third in the Midwest division behind the Spurs and Jazz. Our opponent in the first round of the playoffs, a best 3 of 5, would be the Lakers. These weren't the Lakers who would soon become the NBA's next dynasty. They started the season coached by Del Harris. He was fired after 12 games. They were 6-6, replaced by Kurt Rambis. Yet with Shaq and Kobe and a cast that included forwards Glenn Rice, Robert Horry, and Rick Fox, and point guard Derek Fisher, the Lakers finished with the same record as us. Notice I didn't say supporting cast. Anyway, in Game 1 in Los Angeles, we had the ball and a 1-point lead with less than 30 seconds to go. One more basket, and we might be on our way. I then lost my balance in the lane, the loose ball grabbed by a diving Fisher who wisely called time with 7.6 seconds left. Horry threw it inbounds to Kobe, who was fouled by one of our guards, Sam Mack. Kobe made both free throws. The Lakers were now up 101-100. Timeout Rockets. 5.3 seconds to go. After catching the inbounds pass, Katino Mobley, a talented rookie, drove toward the hoop. The ball was swatted away from behind by Shaq. The buzzer sounded. Gone was a wonderful opportunity to steal one on the road. We didn't get another. The Lakers took Game 2 110-98 and won the series in 4. I couldn't recall the last time I was this disappointed. Perhaps the migraine game in 1990. Or the Hugh Hollins fiasco in 1994. I thought this team had a chance to go to the finals. For the season, I averaged 14.5 points, my lowest output since 1988-89. The offense installed by our coach, Rudy Tomjanovich, wasn't fully to blame. So was the man in the mirror. That man wasn't the same. Whether it was any lingering damage from the two bulging discs or Father Time, I would turn 34 in September, or both, I couldn't go all out on every possession as I did in Chicago. I needed to pick my spots and rely more on my basketball IQ. The story was the same in the playoffs, except for Game 3 when I scored 37 points, a postseason high. I was pathetic. I scored 36 in the other three games combined. In Game 2, I was 0 for 7 from the field. In Game 4, I was 6 for 23. For the series, I shot 33%. I let my teammates, the organization, and the city of Houston down. Unfortunately, I wasn't the only one. Michael was correct. Charles wasn't dedicated enough to win a championship. Not even close. Before the season got underway, Tim Grover, Michael's trainer, came to town to work out with Charles and me. Charles didn't last 1 week. Michael could get away with playing golf and a hectic lifestyle. Charles could not. Something had to give, and that was basketball. He was a lot like Shaq. As great as he was, he should have been greater. In any case, that summer, I spread the word that I wanted out of Houston, if possible, to hook up with the Lakers, who had recently hired a new coach I was a little familiar with, Phil Jackson. Believe me, I hadn't forgotten about Phil having Tony Kukoc take the last shot. That I would never forget. At least I knew Phil wouldn't tolerate players showing up out of shape or not working hard enough. And he, as well as Tex, one of LA's assistant coaches, would make sure everyone got involved in the offense. There would be no standing around watching guys go one-on-one. The game would be fun again. Once Charles learned of my intentions, he opened that big mouth of his. He said I owed the Rockets and him an apology. Okay, Chuck, if that's how you want to play it. I wouldn't give Charles Barkley an apology at gunpoint, I told the press. He can never expect an apology from me. If anything, he owes me an apology for coming to play with his sorry fat butt. I would never have said anything against him if he hadn't gone after me first. What gave him the right? When he did, it brought out the frustration I had kept bottled up for months. I didn't have many years left in my career. I had just wasted one of them. Charles and I are cool now. That was a long time ago. The two of us simply had different approaches to the game, and there was only one way to resolve them. Yes, I was soon on the move again, not to Los Angeles. The owner, Dr. Jerry Buss, wasn't willing to pick up the last year of my deal. I couldn't blame him. He was already paying Shaq a fortune. I'll always wonder what it would have been like to play with Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant. I might have been a Laker until I was 40. Instead, I was headed to Portland in exchange for 6 players: Calvin Cato, Stacey Augman, Walt Williams, Ed Gray, Brian Shaw, and Carlos Rogers. Talk about a soft landing. The Blazers, coming off a loss to the Spurs in the 1999 Western Conference Finals, were loaded. Besides myself, they had recently added Atlanta guard Steve Smith and Seattle forward Detlef Schrempf to a roster that included Rasheed Wallace, Damon Stoudemire, Arvydas Sabonis, Greg Anthony, Brian Grant, Bonzi Wells, and a promising center who had come straight out of high school, Jermaine O'Neal. I could not wait to get to work. Me in Portland, Phil in Los Angeles. Wouldn't it be something if we were to meet in the Western Conference Finals? Slow down, Pip. You had high expectations with the Rockets, and look how that turned out. Portland isn't a big city like Los Angeles. I didn't care. What matters when you are a professional basketball player is where you spend your time and the people you spend your time with. Your teammates, the neighborhood, the organization. Check, check, check. I was used to fast starts with the Bulls, but here was another. 4 in a row, 10 of 11, 13 of 15. Come early December, we were leading our division, a game and a half ahead of the Lakers and the Kings. We cooled off a bit, then regrouped to win 6 straight on 2 occasions. The team was as formidable as I thought it would be, if not more. One game on the schedule in those early months stood out. How could it not? I was going home. That's how I felt about Chicago. Home. No matter how much I had been disrespected, no matter how many times I'd asked the Bulls to trade me, so much had changed since my last appearance at the United Center in Game 5 of the 1998 Finals. For myself, on my 3rd team in 3 years, and for the Bulls, coached by Tim Floyd, who were 2-25, they would finish the season 17-65. In case you're wondering, I didn't feel sorry for Jerry Reinsdorf or Jerry Krause. They were getting exactly what they deserved. The organization was another matter entirely. It didn't deserve this. By the organization, I'm referring to the ticket sellers, the security officials, the maintenance workers, the PR guys, etc., etc. Everyone I ran into told me the same thing. It certainly ain't what it used to be. Prior to the opening tip, the Bulls showed a video of my highlights on the big screen. The ovation I received couldn't have been more generous. For a moment, the fans had something to celebrate. As for the game itself, it was as lopsided as expected. The Bulls committed 31 turnovers in dropping their 11th in a row, 88-63. Damon Stoudemire led us with 16 points and 5 steals. I added 11 points and 6 assists. I felt bad for former teammates who had been left behind, such as Randy Brown, Dickie Simpkins, and Tony Kukoc, who was out with back spasms. Luckily for him, he would be traded a month later to Philadelphia. Same for Will Perdue and B.J. Armstrong in his final season, who were back where they began their careers in the late 80s. I couldn't begin to imagine what they were going through. In late February, we took on the Lakers in Portland. This wasn't a typical regular season game. Both teams stood at 45-11, the best record in the league. Both had won 11 straight. Something had to give. Us, as it turned out. The Lakers prevailed 90-87. Shaq leading the way with 23 points and 10 boards. Kobe had 22 points. The night wasn't a total loss. Our guy showed a lot of resiliency in coming back from an 11-point deficit in the fourth quarter and had a chance to tie the game near the end. I walked out of the Rose Garden with my head held high. Wait until May. We can beat this team. No doubt about it. If only we could beat the other teams on our schedule. From March 1st through the end of the regular season, our record was a lackluster 14-11. With the playoffs about to get underway, there was definitely cause for concern. We didn't have a leader, someone to get on guys when they weren't doing their jobs. Someone, I dare say, like Michael Jordan, even if he went too far on more than a few occasions. Better too far than not far enough. Why not me? I have asked myself the same question many times over the past 20 years. I wish I had a good answer. Being new to the team, I was concerned with fitting in with players who had been around for a while, such as Damon and Rashid. I should have been concerned with doing whatever was necessary to win a championship. Our first opponent in a best-of-five series was the Minnesota Timberwolves, led by a young star, Kevin Garnett. They went down in 4. Next was the Utah Jazz, led by two stars who were not young. Stockton was 38, and Carl was about to turn 37. Yet the Jazz were as gritty as ever, staying alive with an 88-85 victory in Game 4, after losing each of the first three by 18 points or more. The end came in Game 5. Watching those two future Hall of Famers and Hornacek, who was about to retire, reminded me of the memorable duels with the Bulls in 1997 and 1998. I was about to take part in another. I had asked for the Lakers, and here they were, with the winner headed to the finals. With so much on the line, Phil was up to his usual mind games. A year in the Montana woods hadn't mellowed him one bit. The target on this occasion was someone he knew well. I personally think that if Scotty doesn't lead this basketball club and take this team by the horns, Phil told the press, they're not going to get by us. It was my turn to be the snake, and he was looking for a way to cut off my head. This time, however, the Zen Master had met his match. I knew him as well as he knew me, certainly enough not to take his bait. I also knew the triangle. I knew it better than the Lakers players themselves. Whenever I saw how they were set up, I yelled to our guys what was coming next. That had to tick off Phil to no end. Shaq, on the other hand, hadn't met his match. I could yell until doomsday the play they were running, and it would make no difference. In Game 1, which the Lakers won 109-94, he had 41 points, 11 rebounds, 7 assists, and 5 blocks. I played well, 19 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, but we were never really in it. Most disappointing was Rasheed Wallace, who was ejected in the third quarter when he received a second technical. Rasheed was our best player by far. His one fault, and it was a big one, was he couldn't control his anger. He made Dennis Rodman look like a Boy Scout. During the regular season, Rasheed committed 38 technicals, the most in the league. He assured me it wouldn't be a problem in the playoffs. He was wrong. I didn't realize his trouble with the refs went back a ways. And once you have a bad reputation, it follows you the rest of your career. You can forget about getting the benefit of the doubt on any close calls. Rasheed was the Kevin Durant of his day, able to get off a high percentage shot anytime he wanted, with his left or right hand. He was one of the first bigs to run to the three-point line. He could make it from Steph Curry range. Rasheed would need to be at his best for us to win the series. In Game 2, he was 29 points, including 3 of 3 from behind the arc, 12 boards and 2 steals, as we cruised to a 106-77 victory to get the split in L.A. Heading to Portland, we felt good about our situation. Leaving Portland, we felt horrible. The Lakers took both games to go up 3-1. In Game 3, a 93-91 win, Ron Harper, who had signed with the Lakers as a free agent, nailed a 19-foot jumper from the corner with 29.9 seconds remaining to put them on top. Kobe stripped the ball away from Rasheed on the next possession and blocked a shot from Sabonis at the end. In Game 4, the Lakers didn't need any late heroics in prevailing 103-91. They outscored us 34-19 in the third quarter. Shaq was 9-for-9 from the line. What were the odds of that happening? Everyone figured the Blazers were finished. We had other ideas. In Game 5, we jumped out to an early lead on the road and held them off the rest of the way. The final, 96-88. I scored 22 points, including 12 in the first quarter. The win would mean nothing unless we could back it up, which we did, capturing Game 6 in Portland, 103-93. Bonzi Wells was terrific off the bench with 20 points, which brings us to the Staples Center in Los Angeles, California, on the evening of June 4th, 2000. Of all the games in my career, this is the one that keeps me up at night. Not the migraine game, not the 1.8 seconds game, not the Hugh Hollins game. This game. What if I had done this? What if our coach, Mike Dunleavy, had done that? What if I drive myself crazy thinking of all the what ifs? I will explain what took place as best I can. If I can't bear it any longer, I hope you'll understand. At halftime, the score was 42-39 in our favor. Both offenses continued to struggle early in the third. A 19-foot jump shot by Glenn Rice put the Lakers on top 51-50 with under 6 minutes remaining in the quarter. Then it happened. We turned into the 1995-96 Bulls. Over the next 5 minutes or so, we outscored the Lakers 21-4. In that stretch, Steve Smith made 4 field goals, including 2 threes. Rasheed also hit a few baskets, while I nailed a 3-pointer of my own with 20 seconds left to give us a 16-point advantage. Up to that point of the quarter, the Lakers had scored only 16 points. Kobe had 4, while Shaq took 2 shots and missed both of them. The fans were in shock. During his team's final possession, Kobe, drawing a double, passed it to Brian Shaw, who banked in a 3 with a couple seconds to go. A bank? Are you serious? He didn't call bank. I was worried the Shaw prayer might get the Lakers and their fans back in the game. It didn't. Smith hit a bucket early in the fourth to extend the lead to 15, and it was still 15 around the 10-minute mark. Nothing could stop us now. nothing except an inability to make a basket, and that no one on the Portland Trailblazers, including me, a six-time NBA champion, and Dunleavy, a veteran coach, took charge when everything began to fall apart. Where was Phil Jackson when you needed him? Coaching the other team. That's where. Shaq kicked off the Lakers' rally with an easy one in the lane. On the next possession, Brian Shaw, that man again, hit another three. No bank this time. Suddenly, alarmingly, the Lakers were only 10 back. We called time. The fans were into it now. Over the next 6.5 minutes, we missed 11 shots in a row, 13 overall, allowing the Lakers to tie the game at 75. 6 of the 13 misses were from Rashid. Missing shots wasn't our only problem. So was our attitude. It was horrible. During an earlier timeout, Dunleavy had drawn up a play to throw the ball inside to Rashid. The Lakers couldn't guard him in the block. He was almost as automatic as Shaq. Yet as we broke the huddle and walked onto the court, Rashid explained he had a different play in mind. "Smitty," Steve Smith, "fuck with that bitch," Dunleavy just said. Rashid told us, "I'm going to kick that bitch, the ball, out to you, and you shoot the three." I was beside myself. I had been around the game a long time, and I figured I'd heard it all. "Guess again, Pip." I'd never heard a player defy a coach so blatantly and on such a big stage. I should have said something to Rashid before the ref blew the whistle and play resumed. I don't know why I didn't. And it wasn't as if this were a one-time occurrence. Heavens no. The players disrespected Dunleavy all the time, and worse yet, he let them get away with it. He raised his arms in frustration when guys executed a different play from the one he called, but there were never any consequences. He had lost control of the team long ago. Yet despite missing shot after shot and defying our coach, here we were still with an opportunity to reach the finals. Remarkable, really. With just under 3 minutes to go, Rashid scored in the lane over Robert Horry to end the drought and put us ahead 77-75. Then, after Shaq converted 2 free throws, he always seemed to hit them when they mattered most, and made a basket, Rashid secured good position again. Shaq blocked his shot, but was called for goaltending. The score was tied at 79. On the next possession, Kobe was fouled by Rashid. He made both free throws. When we got the ball, Shaq fouled Rashid. He missed both free throws. The second wasn't close. After Kobe hit a jumper, the lead was 4. Then, with about a minute left, I took a 3, my 3rd shot of the quarter. No good. All 3 were no good. That's it. I can't bear to go on with any more play-by-play. I told you that might happen. Lakers 89, Blazers 84. Here's the worst part. The game was for more than the Western Conference title. The game was for the whole thing. The Indiana Pacers, who defeated the Knicks in the Eastern Conference Finals, would be a heavy underdog to whoever emerged from the West. The Lakers won it in 6. To top it off, this was my 2nd and final chance to win a championship without Michael. The first time, Hugh Hollins got in the way. This time, there was no one to blame but ourselves. The Lakers didn't win Game 7. We lost it. Too often that season, guys bickered with one another and with Coach Dunleavy instead of remembering who the real enemy was, the other team. It didn't kill us against everyone else. We had too much talent. It killed us against the Lakers, especially in the 4th quarter when everything began to unravel. When we needed to stick together. When we needed a leader. I spent 3 more seasons in Portland. 3 forgettable seasons. I was always nursing one injury or another. Not once did the Blazers advance past the first round of the playoffs. In 2001 and 2002, the Lakers, on the path to 2 more championships, swept us in a best-of-5 series. Only once in the 6 games was the margin of victory less than 7 points. Dunleavy was fired in May of 2001. I felt bad for him, as I'd felt bad for Doug. Truth is, though, he should probably have been let go a lot sooner. Replacing him was Mo Cheeks, who had been an assistant coach in Philadelphia. Mo's honeymoon lasted about 5 minutes. Guys weren't crazy about his substitution patterns and the way he utilized the roster. The players in that generation were different from the players in my generation. Tex would have had a heart attack if he had to coach this group. There was, however, one night that brought back a lot of memories. It was December 10th, 2002, when we played the Wizards in the nation's capital. Neither team was going anywhere. Surely just another game in an 82-game grind. Not quite. On the Washington roster was a player wearing number 23. Yup, that number 23. How strange indeed for Michael and me to be on opposite sides after all these years, both of us long past our prime. He was in his second season with the Wizards. We didn't go against each other his first season because he was hurt both times our team squared off. Many people thought Michael was tarnishing his legacy by coming back at the age of 38. I was not one of them. He wanted to play the game he loves, and there was nothing wrong with that. If he felt he could still compete today, I guarantee you he would be out there. Neither of us put up great numbers that night. I had 14 points and 7 rebounds. He had 14 points and 5 rebounds. My team won 98-79. Michael retired for good after the 2002-2003 season. For me, there was one act to go. Chapter 18. My Last Dance. On July 1st, 2003, I officially became a free agent for the second time. One of the first calls I received was from a former teammate, John Paxson, the general manager for the Bulls. Jerry Krause had resigned in April after 18 years with the organization. Pax didn't waste any time. "Scotty, we would like you to come here and play for us this year. We need you. Bill Cartwright, the coach, needs you." Safe to say, ending my career in Chicago wasn't something I'd ever thought of during the 5 years in Houston and Portland. In addition to the guys being young and not very good, the Bulls finished 30-52 in the 2002-03 season. I hadn't, if you recall, exactly left town on the best of terms. Besides, now that the end was near, I wanted to go out on top. What athlete doesn't? One possible destination, Pat Riley's Miami Heat, wasn't willing to offer more than the veteran's minimum of $1.5 million per season. After the lack of respect I endured year after year in Chicago, I told myself I would never accept being underpaid again, which left the Memphis Grizzlies as perhaps the most attractive option, and not due to the salary alone, which would be for the same amount the Bulls would offer. Michael Heisley, the owner, brought up the possibility of me purchasing a piece of the team once my playing days were over. Here was one time I did want to be like Mike. Michael Jordan became a minority owner with the Wizards after his second retirement, and today owns the Charlotte Hornets. One place I wasn't headed back to was the Pacific Northwest. The Blazers had recently laid off nearly a third of their front office and arena employees, and clearly weren't about to pay me enough. I felt sorry for the fans in Portland, perhaps the most rabid in the NBA, and will always feel bad I didn't bring them a championship. We came so close. If not for that final quarter against the Lakers in 2000. In the end, I chose the Bulls because I was familiar with the situation. The city, the building, the coach, all of it. I was eager to help Bill, whom I had tremendous respect for, any way I could. He wasn't given the greatest hand to play with when he took over in December of 2001. So much, by the way, for Jerry Krause's faith in Tim Floyd. Floyd's record in a little more than 3 seasons with the Bulls, 49-190. Having family around, Larsa was from Chicago. As she and I in 2000 had started a family of our own, was another important factor in the decision. I signed a 2-year contract for $10.3 million for what is referred to in the league as the mid-level exception. I was never good at math, but I knew that mid-level beat minimum. The role the Bulls had in mind was perfect for an old fogey such as me. I would play maybe 20 to 25 minutes a game, helping youngsters such as bigs Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler, and guards Jamal Crawford and Kirk Heinrich. I was impressed by how gifted they were and the passion they showed for the game. Yet being as raw as Eddie and Tyson were, both went from high school to the NBA before the one-and-done rule went into effect in 2005. They had a great deal to learn. Due to the usual nemesis, my back, I missed the first 5 preseason games. Finally, on October 18th at the United Center, I put on a Bulls uniform for the first time since Game 6 of the 1998 Finals in Salt Lake City. I scored 4 points and collected 3 rebounds and 3 assists. I figured the team was in for a long season, perhaps longer than I thought after what happened on opening night. We lost at home to the Wizards, who, let's face it, weren't exactly the Shaq Kobe Lakers. Lost? Try slaughtered. The score, 99-74. The guys shot 32% from the floor and finished with more turnovers, 18, than assists, 16. We also missed 12 of our 31 free throws. Other than that, 2 nights later, the Hawks came to town. We played much better, our bigs showing why their future was bright. Tyson pulled down 22 rebounds, 9 offensive, and blocked 4 shots. Eddie scored 22 points, including a thunderous dunk to put us up by 4 with about a minute to go, from the future to the past. During halftime, the Bulls unveiled a banner which read, "General Manager Jerry Krause, 6 NBA titles." Once the ceremony honoring Jerry was over, I shook his hand and wished him well. Same for his wife, Thelma. I realize now that plenty of times when Michael and I were critical of Jerry Krause, we should probably have pointed the blame at Jerry Reinsdorf. Reinsdorf made the important business decisions, not Krause. Reinsdorf refused to renegotiate my contract year after year, not Krause. Reinsdorf owned the Chicago Bulls, not Krause. I was on the court for 31 minutes against Washington and 27 against Atlanta. Bad back or not, I was holding up pretty well for a man of my advanced age. Guess again. My left knee, which had been operated on in March, was acting up again. The following night in Milwaukee, I played only 13 and a half minutes, and not very well. 0-for-6 from the field. The Bucks destroyed us 98-68. After undergoing an MRI, I missed the next 4 games. On November 10th, we fell to the Nuggets 105-97, our 4th loss in 5 games at the United Center. So much for home court advantage. Worse yet, a few guys were complaining about being removed from the starting lineup. I thought I was back in Portland. We'd held a team meeting earlier that day, where I spoke longer than anyone else. That was the reason they brought me here, to teach the kids how to behave like professionals. I backed Bill 100%, and not because he was my friend, because he was my coach. He had a right to play whomever he wanted. Afterward, everyone appeared to be on the same page. 2 days later, we defeated the Celtics in Boston, 89-82. I finished with 12 points, 5 rebounds, and 2 steals. Our record was 4-5. Maybe this wouldn't be a long season after all. Maybe we could surprise some people. Not a chance. After 2 more losses at home, to Minnesota and Seattle, the team hit the road. The change in scenery didn't do us any good. On November 23rd, we dropped our 5th game in a row, 110-99, to the Kings in Sacramento. On November 24th, Bill was fired. Our record, 4-10. When I heard the news, it all hit me at once. Here we go again. Even without Jerry Krause, this franchise is as dysfunctional as ever. I should never have come back. I should have taken the Memphis offer, played for a couple of years, and then become one of the owners. What was I thinking? Pax got rid of Bill way too quickly. Bill wasn't the reason we were losing. He didn't pick the players. I deserve some of the blame. I had let Bill down. As a mentor and as a player. In those last five losses, I scored a total of 35 points and had 17 rebounds. If we had won two or three of those games, he might have kept his job. Anyway, once he was let go, I checked out. I started looking for the exit signs. If the Bulls had brought in a good coach to replace him, I might have gotten fired up again. They didn't. They brought in Scott Skiles. I didn't like Skiles, who had coached several seasons for the Suns, from day one. He acted as if he were a tremendous winner with a tremendous work ethic because he'd played with Shaq in Orlando. Give me a break. All he did was pass the ball to Shaq. Anyone could have done that. Skiles couldn't stand Eddie being out of shape. I wasn't crazy about it either. Only his answer was to run everyone to death. I was old school. You don't punish the whole team because one guy is out of shape. My knee, meanwhile, wasn't getting any better. I kept getting the fluid drained. The fluid kept coming back. There was no mystery here. My body was going to break down at some point, and that point had finally arrived. Since the fall of 1987, I'd played a total of more than 49,000 minutes, including the playoffs, and undergone 9 surgeries. I was lucky it hadn't broken down before. Make that 10. After having an operation to clean up some cartilage, I was off for about a month, returning in mid-January against the Pistons. I didn't score a single point. In my next 8 games, I reached double figures only once. The team lost each one of those 8. On January 31st, we took on the Blazers in Portland. The fans were on my side that night, giving me a standing ovation during the introductions. I was quite touched. The basketball gods were also on my side. "Pip, we know you are very close to the end of your career, so for old time's sake, we have decided to give you one last chance to shine. Make the most of it." I did just that, with 17 points, 7 rebounds, and 4 assists in 35 minutes. I hadn't scored 17 points in a game the whole season, or played longer than 30 minutes since November 21st. We lost in overtime, 102-95. 2 nights later, with 9 minutes and 53 seconds to go in the first quarter against the Sonics, I caught a pass from Kirk Heinrich and hit a 21-foot jumper. Nothing special about the basket. Nothing and everything. The basket was my last ever in the NBA. Ironic that it came in Seattle, the franchise that technically drafted me, and almost traded for me in 1994. I soon was back on the injured list and didn't play another game. I finished the season averaging 5.9 points, 3 rebounds, and 2.2 assists. All that was left now was when I would officially announce my retirement. I would wait for the fall, when training camp got underway. No player retires during the off-season. You never know what might change your mind. One day, I received a call from a financial guy with the Bulls. The team still owed me a little more than $5 million for the second year of the contract. I was wondering when we might get around to that. "We would like to spread the money out over a few years," he said. "You okay with that?" Absolutely not. I got my way, which caused more bad blood between me and the organization. As if there hadn't been enough bad blood to last a lifetime. The October 5th press conference at the Berto Center was nothing like the press conference on that unforgettable October day in 1993, when Tom Brokaw was there and David Stern and every cameraman and reporter in America, when fans were in shock that Michael Jordan was leaving the game in the prime of his career. I didn't wear number 23, and people had seen my retirement coming for months. I'll miss the camaraderie of being around the players and competing each and every day, I told the press. That's going to be the hardest thing to deal with. I thank the fans, Jerry Reinsdorf, and John Paxson. It's a tough day for me, I said. But I also understand the game of basketball has been so great to me for so long. Before I knew it, no more pictures were being taken, and no more questions were being asked. Walking out of the Berto Center with Larsa and my two boys, I felt the way I did after finishing high school and college. Now what? One possibility was coaching. Working with the young players in Chicago, I realized I still had a lot to give to the game I loved. The game that changed my life, the game that gave me everything. I knew how to draw up plays and set defenses. I knew how to put the right people in the right positions. I knew how to motivate a group of individuals to act as one. Another possibility was to work for the Bulls in some capacity. Despite how things ended with management, I was still a member of 6 championship teams, and no one could ever take that away from me. I fell in love with the city in the summer of 1986 when I went to visit my sister and played hoops on Lakeshore Drive with Dwayne Wade's father. I never fell out of love. Anyway, after the sacrifices I'd made to get to the NBA and stay there, I was in no rush to figure out the next move. I had a family to raise. With the arrival of another son, Justin, in 2005, there were 5 of us now. A new team to nurture. On December 9th, 2005, the Bulls retired my jersey during halftime of a game against the Lakers. The fans were tremendous. The ovation I received when Johnny Red Kerr, the longtime TV commentator, introduced me is something I'll always cherish. I was hard on them and vice versa, but more often than not, they were in my corner, in the good and the bad times. Having ex-teammates such as Oak, Dennis, Horace, Tony, and others on the stage meant more than I could ever describe. I appreciated as well the kind words from Phil and Michael. Hard to believe 7 years had gone by since the last dance. In March of 2011, the group got together at the United Center to mark the 20th anniversary of our first championship. Michael didn't want to come. I had to convince him, and it wasn't easy. That's one of the reasons the Bulls put me on the payroll as an ambassador in 2010, to get Michael back into the fold, to show the fans and media we were one big happy family. I was playing the same role I did on the court, bringing everyone together. Do it this one time, I told MJ, and I promise I will never ask you again. He was still angry with the organization for not giving us an opportunity to win another championship. Seriously, who else but the Bulls would break up a team after winning it all? Winning not just once, mind you, 3 years in a row, 6 out of 8. On the other hand, I have always felt it was fitting our reign ended when it did. Everything must end at some point, in basketball and in life. We should celebrate change, wherever it might lead us. I'm beginning to sound like the Zen master. Could we have won another title? Without a doubt. The shorter 50-game season would have been perfect for our old legs. Nothing against the Spurs, who with David Robinson, Tim Duncan, Avery Johnson, and Sean Elliott defeated the Knicks in the 1999 finals. Only that we were better. That's true as well for the 2 dynasties that came later. The Los Angeles Lakers of the early 2000s and the Golden State Warriors of recent years. I'll stack our roster against the Warriors any day, especially our second three-peat teams. Let's go through the matchups. Dennis Rodman or Draymond Green at power forward. Dennis. Luke Longley or Andrew Bogut / JaVale McGee at center. Luke. Michael Jordan or Klay Thompson as shooting guard? Michael. Me or Kevin Durant at small forward? You could go either way. The only matchup clearly in Golden State's favor would be Steph Curry over Ron Harper at point guard. One more thing. The Warriors had nobody off the bench as skilled as Tony Kukoc. Prediction? Bulls in six. This series couldn't go seven. After all, we were never extended to a game seven in the finals. As long as we are comparing dynasties, I'm happy I played in my era, and not today. Back then, the game was officiated evenly for the offensive and defensive player. Now, the offensive player has a distinct advantage. Today, by halftime, teams sometimes have 70 points. We used to have plenty of games with the final scores in the 80s. Anyway, when the guys reunited in 2011, it didn't go well. Michael wasn't alone. Everyone felt bad about the way things came to an end. We're still not one big happy family, and that's on the Bulls. They have done very little to honor any of the other five championship teams, including the 1995-96 group that won 72 games. They act as if those teams never existed. Believe me, if this had been the Lakers or the Celtics, and we had won six titles in 8 years, we would be treated like royalty. Those are first-class franchises. The Bulls are not. It's no coincidence they haven't been in the finals since 1998. Even the Cubs have won a championship since then. In the spring of 2010, on the weekend of the Final Four in Indianapolis, I was elected to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. Though I had no doubt that the announcement was coming, I was blown away. In the one-on-one games at Pine Street, when Ronnie Martin and I talked about our dreams for the future, neither of us ever brought up the Hall of Fame. Some dreams are too big to imagine. How then did it happen? How was I able to join this incredibly exclusive club with the likes of Wilt, Kareem, Magic, Michael, and Larry? Luck played a huge role. The right people kept finding a way into my life. And thank God I was wise enough, most of the time, to learn from them. Michael Ireland, Donald Wayne, Don Dyer, Arch Jones, Phil Jackson, etc. Hard work played a huge role as well. I treated every setback as an opportunity, starting with those damn bleachers. The hard work didn't start with me. Heavens no. The hard work started with Ethel Pippen. I saw the effort Mom made every day with my brother, my father, with all of us. There was no limit to the amount of love in that woman's heart. She passed away in February of 2016, at the age of 92. I miss her more than words can possibly describe. For the Hall of Fame ceremony, I needed to choose an official presenter, a person to stand on the stage with me as I delivered my remarks. That individual is required to be a member of the hall. I thought about asking Dr. J, since he was the player I idolized growing up, except I barely knew him. Instead, I picked someone I knew quite well, whose greatness I observed up close day after day, year after year. There really was no other choice. So what if Michael and I weren't best friends? The two of us will forever be linked together, the best duo in NBA history. He helped make my dreams come true, as I helped make his. He said yes right away, and I was extremely grateful. The ceremony in Springfield, Massachusetts, was held on August 13th, 2010. What a night. In addition to being honored for my individual accomplishments, the 1992 Dream Team was also inducted. Seeing the group together again brought back a lot of wonderful memories. In my speech, I thanked my parents, my brother Billy, Ronnie Martin, the Bulls organization, my former coaches and teammates, and of course, Larsa. I played this game that I love so much, and everything I had, I laid it out there, I told the audience. I've also tried to live my life in the way that will make the people I love and care about proud of me. I've been able to live my dream of playing basketball, surrounded by people I love, and being cheered on by the best fans in the world. It was a great ride. Every so often since my retirement, I explore the idea of coaching. I missed the game terribly. In 2008, to show how interested I was, I asked Michael for a job. I prided myself on asking him for as little as possible. He had recently hired Larry Brown to be the head coach of his team in Charlotte, then known as the Bobcats. "Talk to Larry," Michael said. I wasn't offended in the least. Brown was one of the most highly regarded coaches in the game, winning titles in college, Kansas, and the pros, the Pistons. He had a right to pick his assistants and not have the owner interfere, no matter who the owner happened to be. Brown didn't seem interested. "I have the staff I need," he told me. I didn't ask Michael or Brown for a job ever again. On several occasions, I brought up the idea with the people in the Bulls organization. They told me Tom Thibodeau, who coached the team from 2010 to 2015, didn't want me around. I never found out why. Not long after Thibodeau was let go and the Bulls hired Fred Hoiberg, who had been the coach at Iowa State, I realized that I would never be offered a meaningful role in the organization. I moved the family to Florida. One person who gave me a chance to do some coaching early on was Phil Jackson, who was back with the Lakers after a year away from the game. "Come to training camp in Hawaii," Phil said, "and we'll talk after that." This was in the fall of 2005. I worked with the players on different aspects of the triangle. I enjoyed the experience immensely. Working with Kobe was a special thrill. For years, from a distance, I had observed his growth both as a player and a man. To watch him up close, on and off the court, I was even more impressed. His death in late January of 2020 hit me hard. The audition, if that's what it was, couldn't have gone better. However, after it ended, Phil never said another word about any coaching position. I suspect Brian Shaw, one of his assistants, viewed me as a threat, which kept Phil away. I once received an offer from my alma mater, Central Arkansas. I turned it down. I didn't feel it would have been fair to uproot my family. Looking back, my not being a coach worked out for the best. I'd already lived a life where basketball was number one and number two was far behind. I lived that life my whole life. Instead, I was able to lead a different group of youngsters, my kids. I couldn't be prouder of them. They include Antron, Taylor, Sierra, Scotty Jr., Preston, Justin, and Sophia. I think about Antron every day. He passed away a few months ago from complications related to asthma. He was only 33. Antron was one of my best friends. The courage he displayed in dealing with his health problems reminded me a lot of my brother Ronnie. He never saw himself as a victim. I will forever wonder what amazing things he would have accomplished. Speaking of amazing things, I'm excited about the future for Scotty Jr., 21, the eldest of the four children I had with Larsa. He is quite a player in his own right. Last season, as a 6'3" starting point guard for Vanderbilt, he averaged 20.8 points and 4.9 assists. In one game against Cincinnati, he scored 36 points and had 4 steals. Now in his junior year, he has a chance to play in the NBA. Scotty Jr. is a different kind of player from what I was, and the game has changed dramatically since I was his age. Yet, as I watch him in his journey, I think of my own, of how we finally got past Isaiah, Lambeer, and the rest of the bad boys. Of the incredible joy I felt after we beat the Lakers for our first championship. Of the gold medal around my neck in Barcelona as they played the Star Spangled Banner, of gutting it out in Game 6 of the 1998 Finals when I could barely get off the ground, of the coaches who taught me so much about the game and about life. Mostly, I think of the skinny boy from Hamburg, Arkansas, who had nothing going for him but a dream. I think of Pine Street and Grandma's dirt court, and of the day in high school I almost quit running the bleachers. While I gasped for air on those steps, I heard an inner voice speaking to me with more urgency than ever before. The voice was saying the same thing my teammates were saying, a message I would carry from that day forward, from one challenge to the next. Come on, Pip. You can make it.
Unguarded was written by Scottie Pippen with Michael Arkush and read by J.D. Jackson. Editing, mix, and post-production by Common Moe, Paul Fowley, technical director. The associate producers were Joy Osukwo and Claire Tatakoro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Unguarded is available in print from Atria Books.